All right. So today we're with the collective minds of the programming languages at Microsoft. Please introduce yourselves.
I'm Herb Sutter. I'm an architect on the Visual C++ team.
Eric Meyer. I work with the VB and the C-sharp team. Teams.
I'm Brian Beckman. I work with Eric Meyer.
I'm Anders Halsberg. I'm a technical fellow at C-sharp.
Outstanding. So we'll set up this interview today to talk about two related topics, composability and programming languages. Since the developer, that's what we get to see when we want to create systems. You guys are the ones who are thinking up the syntax and infrastructure for me to use as a developer. So one of the things I want to talk about is how do you guys work together, right? You have C Sharp, VB, and then C++. All your languages are evolving. Clearly they're used for different things. C++ more systems, C Sharp, VB more sort of the application level. Yet you guys are innovating each of your languages. So how does that work? Do you work together? How do you think up these innovations? Do you think them up together, or do you come up with the ideas and then share? That's really what I'm asking. I know it's a weird question, but try to answer.
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, Eric actually, you know, worked on the C Omega project way back when, and then some of the Link stuff that we're doing, there's obviously a lot of similarities there and a lot of cross-influence and so I think there's continuously there's a conversation going on, you know. Eric actually sits in on the C-sharp design team, so we all keep abreast of, you know,
of what other language
what we're doing. The VB guys are like the C++ guy. I mean, we're all in the same building. We bump into each other all the time.
Sure.
So I think it's just osmosis and conversation and
But I mean, do you guys differentiate yourselves as far as your target audience? For example, there's things you can do in VB that you can't do in C#. For example, be entirely late bound in a very simple way in VB. Right. You don't really have to think about it. You wouldn't do that in C#. Why would that be? Because of your target?
I think it's more a question of history. I mean, you sort of have to take the historical perspective into consideration here, especially when you're talking about VB. VB has a long, rich history and started out as a late-bound language. There were no types at all. And so, obviously, late binding has always been sort of front and center in VB, and VB has then since evolved into a more strongly typed language, and you could say, and now you can almost characterize it as a strongly typed language that supports late binding. But it really is the opposite, you know. C# started out, you know, always being strongly typed, and we have so far, you know, held off on introducing late bound support. That's not to say that we wouldn't do that sometime in the future, but we would probably do it in a different manner than it's done in VB, and we try to probably wall it off a bit more, you know. But it has its uses, right? I mean, if you're talking to an old, loosely typed object model like any Olay automation thing, you know, then, you know, if the types aren't there to begin with, you know, it's a lot easier to talk to it in a late bound fashion than in an early bound fashion, because now it just sort of devolves into a bunch of method info.invoke reflection stuff, you know,
which is done for you under the covers, which is not the
right. Exactly. Yeah.
Interesting. So,
and the differences between languages too. Some of it comes down to audience and the kinds of things the tools are used for. So performance has always been a core, a principal thing for C and C++ programmers, being close to the metal. Mm-hmm. And so you might find that some features might be different in the languages. But more often, I think you'll find driven by the same kinds of concerns. For example, concurrency no one can ignore. Mm-hmm. No language will be able to ignore concurrency and stay successful for mainstream programming over the next 5-10 years, just sure. Because of where the hardware is going. It's a really whole new era where we're not programming von Neumann machines anymore, so for the first time in 50 years. And nobody can really ignore that. So there are some things that are going to be in common, and you're going to see addressed, but not necessarily in the same with the same syntax or with exactly the same features in each. And a lot of the languages, I'm sure, will see some of the same features added in different orders because there's different priorities for different developer communities or the customers are asking for different things, and so we might do them in different orders. So, like Anders said, it's a little bit of each.
Sure. Interesting.
Yeah, so I can give a kind of a concrete example where we kind of had a very different thing between VB and C Sharp, and in this case it's like anonymous functions or lambda expressions. So we were kind of, well, we want to add them to VB as well. So what we were trying to kind of look at is what is the right syntax. So we kind of asked the VB, the MVPs, there's kind of a mailing list where the MVPs, and they were kind of all in favor of having kind of more verbose syntax. So instead of the kind of fat arrow as in C Sharp, they wanted to have the kind of function keyword because they felt it was more VB-ish. So that's where you see there's a kind of, you know, it's a more syntactic difference. But also there is a semantic difference there as well, because if you look at closures, if you have like, you know, an anonymous functions inside, you know, deeply nested like in a for loop, is how do you kind of capture the variables, or when do you kind of, how many, how are they kind of instantiated? So in C Sharp, they're instantiated each time around the loop, whereas in VB, kind of variables are kind of implicitly hoisted to the top, much like in Python and in JavaScript. So there, you know, there's a kind of semantic difference there as well in how variables are captured. So it's kind of an interesting, you know, sometimes these things are very subtle. You have to write kind of really crazy programs to see that difference.
I was just going to say, if you ever write a program that takes a dependency on that, we'll fine you $100.
Exactly. Exactly.
Or award you $100.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah,
award you,
yes.
Then we'll fine you.
Yes, right.
Excellent. So that being said, though, I mean, each of your languages has to innovate and evolve. With VB and C Sharp, you guys have the same core processing engine underneath you, so you're kind of stuck to what the CLR is evolving, how the CLR is evolving. C++, you're in a different world, obviously, but you all have to innovate. You have to make it, may have to make the developer want to use C Sharp to do something as opposed to VB.net, right? I mean, it's not just syntax difference. There has to be some core innovations happening in your languages that you want to attract people to use them.
I think that's true, but I don't necessarily agree with one of the ways you just put that.
Sure. Which
is that we have to add something to language X to make people want to use that instead of other Microsoft language Y. Well, I don't think that's necessarily true.
Fair enough.
I think I would put it, at least for me, more in the sense of the people who are using language X, say C++ or C Sharp, what do they need that I can help them do their job better? That might be a feature in language Y as well, or that's being added there. But my job for Language X is how can I make them successful doing that job? Mm. And if they want to use Language Y for part of their project, which is the whole point of having the common language runtime, and having native interop and all of those things, how do I make that work well? Because it's not a one-language world anymore. The days are gone when you write a whole project in one language. Nobody does that anymore, not for anything of any real size. Uh-huh. And so whether you use scripting languages for some things and GUI tools and widgets and a systems language underneath for one thing, you're constantly assembling things. And this gets to what you were saying about composability, because composability is inherently cross-language. Because you write a web browser, you have no idea if the plugin that you're putting in was written in C Sharp or in C++ with CLI extensions or something else. They got to work together, though. And that's one of the grand challenges, too, because to make that happen means that we have to keep on paying attention to those things that made the common language runtime and technologies like it successful, but keep doing that in a world of, say, locks, where concurrency is getting more important, but locks don't compose at all, full stop.
Yes.
So that is a key barrier to composability. And so I'm sort of segueing onto your other
That's
topic,
great. This
but
is
that's,
perfect.
But it really is a language interop thing more than a language competition thing, at least to me.
Well, yeah. let me pop in here and say that I kind of represent the user. I'm a physicist. I'm always writing little programs to do simulations and visualization and solve mathematics problems. And composability is absolutely critical to my success. I couldn't care less about the programming language. What I care about is that there are components out there that I need to use. I'm exaggerating to make the point. Of course I care about the programming language, otherwise I wouldn't be here. But I'm perfectly willing to use whatever programming language makes my job easier.
Cobol.net.
Yeah, well, I'm actually going to put on my very old man hat here and talk about, historically, one of the very few successes of software reuse in the world, and that is numerical libraries like GAMS and TOMS and LAPACK and ISPACK. These are things written in Fortran decades ago, and people have been using them for decades to solve very serious scientific problems. nobody in his right mind would sit down and write a new linear algebra package from scratch without looking at this kind of stuff. There's serious mathematics, serious mathematicians have spent their careers developing this kind of thing. And we need interoperability. It's not just interoperability, we need composability. And, you know, just to talk about how the weakness of a programming language can influence composability in this way, everyone knows that Fortran does not support recursion in any way, shape, or form because everything's passed by reference. So that's leaked through to the interfaces of these packages. If you need to integrate something that itself does an integration, you cannot use the same package to do the integration at both levels. You just can't. So I don't know, where was I going with this? I'm just telling physicist stories. But let me get back to C++, C Sharp, and VB.
Yes.
All of which I will use any day, any given day, for any reason whatsoever.
Okay.
I like C Sharp because I like operator overloading. Why do I like operator overloading? Because I'm doing mathematics and strange algebras like quaternions and octonions. Mm-hmm. And I like having a little plus that actually means plus instead of some giant pile of weird stuff that you know, it would look like.
Maybe
if
you
I
want
were
to use
it.
Templates, man.
I might even... No, I wouldn't want to use templates. because the minute I use templates, I'm going to say, oh, you know what? The template processor is Turing equivalent, so maybe I can do a list processing library. Just use... I'll get distracted by pretty mathematics, but... I've had applications where I absolutely needed to do late binding, and this mm-hmm. little calculator simulator I did last year for a programming contest, late binding was critical to the success of that thing, so VB was a natural pick. And C++, gee whiz, well, mostly I use C++ for implementing other languages. It's an ideal platform for that kind of thing. I've implemented Scheme and half a dozen times and deployed it in various scientific applications. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I'm just riffing on composability as something necessary.
But I think there has sort of been, if you look like historically over the last 10 years, there has been a subtle shift from, I mean, if I go back to when I started, you know, the learning curve for someone coming into the programming field was all about learning the language that they were programming in, mm-hmm. and then the other language where everything was all different and so forth. And the syntax was actually a big part of the surface area you had to go learn. And then there was a little runtime library. And now we have these gigantic frameworks that just get bigger and bigger every day, and the syntax is just a cherry on top in a sense, right?
Mm,
and,
yes.
And I really think we've made tremendous strides in unification there without really... It's funny how we all... Language is like the color of your glasses, right? Everything is rose-colored or purple or whatever, you know, depending on what language you program in. But the reality is that the meat and potatoes of it is really, you know, learning all of the APIs of whatever platform or framework you're programming on top that gets bigger and bigger and bigger every day. And it's like in the 90-something percent of your learning curve at this point, right?
Sure.
And then you look at VB, C Sharp, and even managed C++, you know, you can like with no friction whatsoever, switch between these languages and use, you know, parts of a project that was written in one. You can have solutions that combine the languages. I mean, that's major progress, you know, compared to where we were.
Sure.
Not that long ago, actually.
Yeah.
And it of course all comes from having a common type system and all of these abstractions that are in every language and yet for
mm-hmm.
typically end up being just sort of subtly different in every language for no particular good reason, right? And
sure.
then it causes all sorts of pain.
Yes, and there are some circumstances in which multiple languages are a serious impediment. Like web programming nowadays is enormously painful because you have to know PHP, JavaScript, HTML, XML, SQL, and that's just so you can put up a little square where you type in your name. So that, you know, sometimes... having multiple languages around is very helpful, as
mm-hmm.
in being able to pick your syntax over...
But the difference with web programming is that there the languages are not unified. There's
exactly.
no kind of underlying
yes.
substrate. So you're
yes.
kind of forced in these kind of very different worlds. Whereas
mm-hmm.
with the CLR, you know, since everything uses the same libraries, that's where, you know, the language is like less of an issue because you can choose.
Right.
But on the web, you're forced to a particular language.
A lot of our work is focused around trying to mitigate that situation, mostly by broadening the platform,
mm-hmm.
you know, adding more capabilities, you know, more .NET libraries.
But the
Link, for example.
The languages like VB and C Sharp and not C++ really are, like you're saying, they're really tied to the framework. But isn't that limiting in some sense? For, what I mean by that is, let's talk about functional programs for a minute. How does that fit into this massive framework that you're talking about? Like, why are, like, Haskell and F Sharp are very popular languages, but they're completely different constructs.
Okay, well, that's in some sense, what is kind of interesting to see is that traditionally, if you're programming in an imperative language, your kind of, you know, building block is statements.
Mm-hmm.
And statements kind of use kind of shared state. And that makes them kind of not very compositional. You cannot take two kind of statements and kind of glue them together because they kind of communicate via some global state. That makes imperative programs not very kind of composable.
Hmm.
If you look at Link, we're kind of moving much more to a functional programming style where everything is expression-based. And expressions are by definition compositional because, you know, like how do you create a new expression by combining smaller expressions into a larger ones?
Hmm.
And things like lambda expressions and so on. So in some sense, I think there's not much in C-sharp 3 and VB9 that's not in languages such as Haskell and F-sharp. There's a kind of maybe the esoteric things. If you look at the Haskell type system,
mm-hmm.
there the type system kind of keeps track of side effects. And that gives you kind of some form of composability because now you cannot kind of take something that has a certain side effect and combine it with something that has other side effects, or you can only combine things that have the same side effects. And then F-sharp in particular has kind of very powerful type inference mechanisms. But I think there's also because F-sharp was kind of designed from scratch with type inference in mind. And I think, before we had generics, type inference was not a big deal, but now there kind of things have crept in like overloading and so on that make kind of, you know, type inference quite hard. So, but you know, if you look at it kind of, you know, from that perspective, I think we are going very much to a very functional programming style and very compositional using expressions and lambda expressions and so on.
Which
I think there are some, and I've talked about this before. I mean, but it's. I mean, some of the reasons why we're so interested in functional programming, it's not just, you know, like just an academic interest, right? I mean, it turns out that one of the big challenges I think we sort of face two challenges with programming languages going forward. One is just the old quest of continuously making programmers more productive, right?
Yeah.
And I think the way forward there, I think, and the way forward certainly has been, move the abstraction level up, right? And give people, you know, things like garbage collection and type safety and exception handling and now like a form of declarative programming like Link and whatever. And you know, moving up, I think Eric points out, you know, that these kinds of declarative programming require a much higher level of composability. And functional programming is wonderful because if you can make promises about no side effects and whatever, you can become enormously more composable.
Sure.
But then there's also the interesting sort of elephant in the room of you know, what are we going to do with multi-core processors and many cores and 32 CPUs, you know, and how are we going to keep them all busy? And certainly when we get into a more functional and declarative style of programming, it is much more likely that we can build runtime infrastructures that can make intelligent choices and take advantage of all of these cores because
sure.
they can like parallelize your algorithms and so forth, where if it's written in an imperative style, there's precious little you can do because you kind of can't see the underlying problem
sure.
for all of the little, you know, movements of take this X and put it there and put this there, and it all has to come in sequence or else we can't make any guarantees anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
So
that's interesting. I mean, the thing though, when you have a big processing engine like the CLR, the point is that really should abstract away that for me as a developer, right? Why can't... So if I'm hitting a four-core machine, you'd think that the processing, the runtime engine, would be able to handle the work of targeting the processor.
You would think so, but the CLR and most runtimes that certainly are sort of in use today in the industry are really sort of imperative engines, you know, that have fairly traditional instruction sets, you know, that with a stack or whatever, and mutable state, you know, including mutable global state and whatever. So you can do functional programming because functional programming, in a sense, is a subset of that capability set, right?
Okay.
And we sort of want to be maximally flexible, but it's just that functional subset is becoming more and more relevant and will become more and more mainstream, I think.
I think there's a good opportunity here to tease apart two things in the functional space, though, because I just agree overwhelmingly with what Eric and Anders have been saying. The way I've tended to look at it is with slightly different words. That is, we're still using imperative languages because it's what people understand. The general programmer has not had huge success, nor have we had great supermarket acceptance of everything as a rule kinds of, or everything as an expression kind of languages. They like to have a cookbook recipe, do this, then do this, a stepwise recipe. But what we really have drawn well from the functional languages is not the core, the fundamental way they're expressed, but lambda functions and expressions of side effects. The ability to talk about expressions as first-class citizens, like Link does, and takes that a very long way, and to be able to talk about the lambdas and closures and say what side effects on things are. That last one's actually still missing.
Yes.
We really need to do that in all imperative languages.
Yep.
But the reason I just chimed in on that is because I think it would be a mistake to say, well, functional languages are the way forward. We'll just have to leave this imperative junk behind because it's not good enough.
Oh, yeah. No,
or we'll just move them all to functional languages, because I don't think there's much evidence that programmers can deal with functional languages, at least not the way they are now, for general purpose code and for systems code. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of good stuff there that we can apply, and that's what C# has done. That's what ISO C++ is doing with lambdas and closures, that I think will add a lot of value. And the other thing about functional languages, right, is there are two kinds of functional languages. The ones that don't have any side effects, so that they don't have the problem of mutable shared state, and the ones everybody uses.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Because you just can't say, oh, I'm perfectly concurrency safe, because every time I take a copy of this million element vector, or every time that I modify one element, I take a copy of it. So great, there's no mutable shared state.
Yeah.
You will not get far.
Yeah, and I think what I meant was really more that having functional constructs in an imperative programming language like C# or VB gives us now the ability to write libraries that are functional in style, where we can make it very clear that if you can promise us that the lambda you pass here is a pure function, then we can split this out and run it on n threads or n CPUs, you know, and then join the results at the end, and poof, it went faster, and you didn't have to change your program at all. But we'll never be able to tease that out of a program that was written as one gigantic for loop, right? And that's where their functional, the functional programming gives you a level of expressiveness that makes it much easier to construct these kinds of composable algorithm blocks, because you can pass code as parameters, so to speak.
Sure.
Do you know what I'm saying? And have it all, and have all the types be correct around it, and through type inference and generics and so forth.
But does that decrease abstraction?
Well, let me put on my devil's advocate hat there, because I agree enormously with that, and I think, and I want to point out that we all hand wave in all of our languages about the just promise us that it doesn't have side effects.
Right.
Because the reason we have to rely on the programmer to promise is because, well, we in the language don't know until we do some more work in our languages to let people declare side effects and that kind of thing, which I think we've all been thinking about and hand-wringing over the best ways to do. And so that's going to keep getting more mind share and thought. But we trust the programmer because we don't know. However, the programmer also doesn't know in many cases because he's writing a function that calls a library.
Yes.
So composability comes in here again.
Yes,
he
absolutely
has no idea what side effects his composable library does.
Right.
So we can keep putting it off another level of indirection, but the problem is that today nobody knows unless you control the whole code base. And, you know, that's just that whole argument that can be applied equally to locks, because locking also is a global property and a barrier to composability.
Yeah. This is where Haskell comes in, though, because it's an example of doing it always without side effects.
Yes, but that also comes with a lot of pain. Because
absolutely.
Because the thing is, now it becomes all explicit. So once your code has side effects, and you put it on the programmer's plate to kind of put your programs in a certain sequence, because you have to kind of say, oh, I do this before that, because the side effects are relevant. Mm-hmm. So then you're really kind of, in some sense, programming in assembly language, because you cannot write expression plus expression. No, you will have to kind of decide, first evaluate this expression, then evaluate that expression, and then combine them. So I don't think we have hit the sweet spot there, you know. So it's like...
No, but we do have examples on the extremes. So
yes.
So this is good news. We have Haskell out there who shows you the absolutely purest way to do it at the expense of practicality. And then we have various kind of dirty languages.
Thus, it's a research language.
The ones you actually...
Yes, and by design, that's why I say
it. It's neither black nor white.
Exactly.
Right? I just think we're starting to arrive at a happy medium, you know, that and making slow progress. And
yes,
I completely agree that it would be lovely.
So from
if we could actually make guarantees about purity of functions, and ultimately we're going to have to get there.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of work in the research world about this too, with the contract languages and contracts and constraints and what's some of the other lingo, Eric?
Yeah. Well, but here's the thing, right? With side effects, a lot of side effects are not bad, right? If I'm writing a function that uses a local variable, I mean, it uses state, but the function itself is still pure. Mm. And so there's kind of, you know, you also want to encapsulate side effects. I think it's a very hard problem. So some things are kind of locally impure, but globally pure.
Stepping back just on the whole composability thing, one thing that I find amazing is how surprised people are that composability is a problem, than even though you would have expected they would have run into that brick wall so many times by now and know better.
Yeah.
But our entire software industry, our entire world is based on composable software.
Yes.
You download a web browser, then you download 3 plugins. And one of the key things, I mean, I've talked to hardware companies at hardware conferences a lot lately, just getting it slumming in the hardware world. Sorry, they're slumming in the software world too.
Yeah.
And talking about, well, you know, if we have all this parallelism in the hardware that we got to exploit, and the best thing we have today to deal with mutable shared state is locks, and locks are global. It's a global property that doesn't compose. Now, I'm deadlock prone all the time. I can't call any unknown code while holding a lock. And so I don't have this composability. And I get sometimes blank faces. Well, why is that a problem? And then I point out that, okay, you went on the web and you downloaded your favorite new piece of software. Maybe it's a web browser that somebody just released. And you download 3 plugins and you use them. And they say, yeah. And then I point out, do you realize that it is quite normal, and you just did it, where the first time that software is composed is on the end user's machine? How are you going to test for that? And that's when I start seeing panic in about 10% of the faces in the room. Because they hadn't thought about that. Well, how are we going to test? Because it's been composed for the first time on that end user's machine. And that's one reason why composability is even more important. Never mind Ajax-like applications and other kinds of plugins and helpers that are constantly being downloaded and asking to play inside your UI experience.
Yeah. So one of the questions that comes immediately to mind, re-functional programming and what you're talking about, is does it help programmer productivity to add a new level of something that you need to think about and be aware of? Like, now I have to think about side effects. Because I'm writing stuff today in C# or whatever, I'm not thinking about side effects in the way that a functional programmer would, which is what you were talking about earlier.
One problem is you can't make a language simpler by adding more features. Right?
Okay.
That's one basic problem there.
Sure.
You run a guy.
But I mean, talk about
like
abstraction.
In programming languages, it's just all you can do as a language designer is slow down the accrual of new features that will eventually lead to cave in, right? I mean, because you can never take away. I mean, in theory, you can take away, but in reality, you cannot take away because you're going to break so much code that and it's just not practical, you know.
Yeah, look what happened with VB6 to VB.NET.
Yeah.
People screaming bloody murder.
Sure.
But
it was a different language.
Exactly. That's the resolution is
just
to say it's a different language. But creeping featureitis is a law of nature. But adding functional programming, I think functional programming ideas have been around for quite some time, and younger programmers coming out of college are at least aware of them and aware of some of the advantages.
Mm-hmm.
They have seen lambda expressions in Python or JavaScript or something like that.
Sure.
Or they've been educated using Scheme, and you know, it's not a foreign concept. So if they see it in C# or something with more of a traditional background like VB or C++, it doesn't scare them, and they may, even the more sophisticated among them, may be aware of the advantages, that this will enhance their composability if they can use it intelligently and control. You know, composability in an imperative language takes programmer discipline. In some ways, Haskell programming, whereas it's vastly more painful than programming in an imperative language, it's also easier because you can't mess up.
One thing I just want to add to this is also that I think one of the things, at least I'm hoping we're doing with the work in C# and VB is to a large extent demystifying functional programming, because academia has a tendency to sort of make things sound more complex than they need to be at times, because you sound smarter that way, I'm not meaning to diss anybody, but I mean there's a lot of symbolic math and whatever, and when I explain lambda expressions to people, they're sort of like an aha moment where they go, you mean they're just functions? I mean, there's
a big deal.
So what's up? We already have those. This is just syntactic sugar, isn't it? But it's very powerful syntactic sugar, and it allows you to sort of think of the problem in a different manner, and gradually all of the noise that was there, the syntactic noise that was there previously from having to declare functions and make delegates to them or whatever, it all dissipates. And out of the fog comes, you know, a whole new level of expressiveness and that's really the key there. But there's a lot of mysticism that has surrounded functional programming, that I feel like hopefully we'll manage to break through.
Kind of dispel it. Just on a different note, what you were talking about education and people learning some of these things in school, I really hope that's true. I'm not convinced that's true, or there's more than a passing acquaintance. It seems like people either in school or in their own careers afterwards seem to very often believe that they have had exposure to a variety of programming languages. They know lots of different programming languages because they've used C and C# and C++ and VB and Pascal.
Yeah.
Which are essentially the same.
They're
language.
The same language.
They're the same family of languages. They have not done APL, which looks like you typed in XC to your command shaft. It does not look like Prolog, where everything is a rule.
Yeah.
Lisp, everything is a list or an expression. Yeah. And until you've sort of dipped in, dunked your head in two or three of these, and you realize, you know, not everything is a command. Maybe you'll go back and write commands for the rest of your life, like most of us have done.
Yeah.
But you won't be in ignorance that there are other ways to look at the world. It's like somebody who's not traveled more than a mile away from the town they grew up in. You know, New York is a pretty fun place.
Yeah.
Whether you want to live there or not, you should know about it and have experienced it. You know, that kind of thing.
Yes. Well, I think the change is very gradual, but I definitely detect a more awareness of functional programming ideas in younger programmers coming along. You know, 10, 15 years ago, if you talk about Scheme, people look at you like you're, what? What are you talking about? And nowadays, people have heard of it. And and they have seen, you know, the function keyword. People have dabbled in JavaScript or Python, which is where I think they're getting popularized.
Yeah.
But it's not a big, it's not, I don't see a sea change or, you know, a seismic shift. I see a gradual increase of awareness. And it doesn't scare people the way it used to.
Well, maybe JavaScript is actually the world's most, you know,
Scheme and C++.
Yes, so,
it's very pretty.
I'm not sure that a lot of people are going to realize that when they use JavaScript, but it is. I mean, this is a language that has first-class functions, and so it's...
And you can create them on the fly
and
mess them around.
And everything is the same type. Everything's an object, right? I mean, it's...
Yep.
Yeah. It's an interesting language, and with the whole web thing now, you think that language needs to evolve a little bit.
Oh, but you know, it isn't the case that everything is an object in the object-oriented sense. It is the case that everything is an association list. See, now I'm talking as an old lisper, right? a JavaScript object is not not like a C# object, where you know the fields are laid out and you know everything statically. You can add things and take them away and violate the rules. It's really just an association.
Yes.
Because it's interpreted.
Property bag.
Yes.
It's a property bag. Is even better.
Where things were.
Where modern ways.
Yes, and where the values can be functions or other objects or other property bags.
Yes.
Sorry. Yeah. So
So it really, really is just Lisp or Scheme. I keep coming back to Scheme, but maybe I'm the only one in the room old enough to have heard of it. But Scheme is sort of God's Lisp, with all the noise boiled away and down to the very basic minimum. And JavaScript has brought this into the forefront in a more less scary clothing, because it looks C-ish.
With
it's curly braces, or
but the development
as in Dutch and Cleo Hackett,
curly braces.
Yeah, but JavaScript is just an interpreted language. For a developer, the way that you actually interact with the language is not very, it's not very productive. It doesn't have the IDE that you can present with a real object-oriented language with a framework underneath it, like C#.
Well, I mean,
it's
a loosely typed language.
Yes.
I would say, or a dynamic programming language. But often, you know, I mean, people sort of confuse compilation time with how strongly typed it is. And really, the two are separate concepts, right? Yeah. You can have something that is strongly typed but compiled at runtime, if you will. I think, I mean, to me, and I've talked about this before, too, it's like I find it very interesting to try and tease apart what it is people find appealing about dynamic languages and scripting languages. And often it's this notion that there are no types that get in my way, or I don't have to declare things, I can just do it and whatever. And that certainly gets you going faster, but there is a flip side to that where, you know, because you have no types, we can offer you a lot less help.
Yes.
When you say X dot,
yep.
Sorry,
what's
we can't really tell you. We don't have a lot of intelligence to show you here because we have no bloody idea what X is gonna be. Now sometimes we can guess, but we're gonna get that wrong, and sometimes we have just no idea, right? X for some parameter, but that we don't know. We don't know what it's gonna be.
Yeah.
What I find interesting is you know, this the stuff that we're doing, the type inference in C#, and the stuff that, you know, like Haskell is nothing but type inference. In many ways, you get to write programs that look like they're dynamically typed because you don't say the types all the time, or maybe never, but they're still there statically, which means we still can give you intelligence and statement completion.
So specifically, the var keyword.
The var keyword is an example of this, right?
Take
the var keyword looks like it's dynamically typed, but it's statically typed. And we know what the type of a var blah is, and then when you say blah dot, we can show you.
Interesting.
And the same thing in IC++ auto got reused to do exactly the same kind of thing. Just I have a vector of int, and I take a begin out of it. Why do I have to say vector of int :: iterator again? The compiler knows the type.
Right.
Come on, you just have to choke it and make it cough it up.
Yeah.
And so that's when you say var or auto, it's come on to the compiler, you know, don't make me spell it out again.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And that has a lot of advantages anyway, just for writing better generic code, because that can be a barrier to write a generic code.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, there's a bunch of help we can give you when you're writing the code. And quite honestly, IntelliSense today, I mean, if you take away IntelliSense, that's like...
No.
That is just a big no-no. It is such a useful tool,
it's
right?
Huge.
But there's also just performance. I mean, you know, when the compiler knows what the type of something is, it can create better code for it, you know, and that so you can get better efficiency.
Sure.
So
there's a very interesting anecdote. We had a compiler dev lab a couple of months ago, and then the participants kind of said, oh, you know, F# is the best dynamic language, whereas I think F# is kind of the language that has the most kind of advanced static type system. It's the least dynamically typed, but it's kind of, you don't have to write any types because the compiler infers everything for you. So it's kind of interesting that people kind of confuse writing types with dynamically typed.
And these
were
professional compiler writers.
Yes.
This was a poll taken at the end of the class. What's your favorite dynamic language?
Yes.
F#.
Well, because doesn't that stuff
fool the pros with stuff like that?
But doesn't dynamic, and that for a developer's point of view, it happens at design time. For me, if I don't have to strongly type something, I'm going to assume that it's dynamically typed for me.
You know
is
what?
That,
I think
is that a wrong way? I mean, I'm not thinking about the compiler.
There's a difference between dynamically typed and implicitly typed, right? I mean, there's the notion that the compiler figures out what the type is, but it does know at compile time.
Okay.
Versus, it has no bloody idea at compile time. It's going to assume it could be any type, and then we'll insert the appropriate runtime checks to figure out what the type really is, right?
Okay.
Which means when you dispatch a virtual call, well, it's got to go through some lookup table or whatever, because you have no bloody idea what the thing is yet, right?
Okay.
Whereas at compile time, you know, depending on whether it's C# or C++, well, you can lay out vtables and know exactly it's an indirection through this memory location to get there because I've figured it all out already.
Mm.
So you're doing a lot of the work up front, effectively, right? But people have confused that with, I must, me, personally, be manually involved and tell you the types all the time. And that's really not necessary, because types can be inferred. If you know the type in one place, you can probably sort of follow what happens here in the program logic and how do the types flow, and you could know what the type is over there
mm-hmm.
as well, if you're smart enough as a compiler, right? And that smartness is what we're starting to move into our programming language.
And F# is probably the best example of this right now. There, and this is how you fool the professionals. I think what people really like is quick feedback. They like the quick turnaround. And then they confuse this with dynamism in their minds.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what I mean by this. Type a function, and then type a line of code and test the function right now. And if it works, then you can forget about it. And this allows people to keep their mental stack full, and it's people power.
Mm-hmm.
Dynamic interpreted languages are historically very good at this. You open up Lisp, what do you get? You get a Lisp listener. You type your code, and your tests write in exactly the same environment. But it's really a tools issue. It has nothing to do with the compiler whatsoever. You can have dynamic languages with good IDE and interactive development.
Mm-hmm.
You can have static languages like F# with good IDE and interactive development. That's what Don Syme does in his F# demos. He gets this big, monstrous piece of code. He scrapes the mouse over it and presses go, and it executes. And then he gets another blob of code. He scrapes the mouse over it and he presses go. And everybody thinks it's dynamic and interpreted. It's static and fully compiled. So this is how you fool the pros.
Yeah.
But this is what people really like. They like good tools that it's called a REPL loop or an IDE or an interactive development environment, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
It lets you type code right away. You don't have to write a bunch of code to do tests. You can just say, hey, I've made a function called random double. Let me type that in and see if it works.
Mm-hmm.
And if it works, they can forget about it until debugging later.
But you can't do that in C#. You can't highlight a function and see if it works. So you have to compile the whole program.
Not yet.
Which
yeah,
is why
you have to put a bit of fluff around it. But, you know,
yeah,
that's
getting
that's something maybe we ought to take a look at. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah,
well, you have to link in all the libraries.
No, but that again, is
that's,
a tooling
that's,
thing,
yes.
right? I mean,
that's
just
tooling.
Yeah.
It's
there,
tooling.
There's
yeah.
no inherent barrier to being able to do that. And
right.
Okay.
It's just a question of tooling. Do you want to
right.
have the investment? Is that something that's important for developers?
Yeah.
And gets back to, well, different languages will add that kind of
and
thing.
And certainly dynamic languages are showing us that it is important too.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, they historically
yeah.
work that way. It's,
so.
It's actually a historical accident. The dynamic languages have always been associated with these
command
interactive
line. Yeah,
command
yeah,
line
yeah,
interactive
yeah,
environments.
Yeah.
APL is the mother of all these things. Type in /, parenthesis, and go, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's another one that can be statically compiled.
So let's talk a little bit about, it sounds to me like what we're pointing in the direction for the evolution of our languages is a combination of imperative and functional, correct? So, I mean, it
a
seems
combination
like
of dynamic and static. And
honestly,
I think the meta trend is just like this big fusing of all of the various disciplines.
Sure.
Like classical, object-oriented, functional, dynamic, you know, that we're all borrowing ideas from each other, and then the silos are much less well-defined than
mm-hmm.
they used to be.
Now, do you think that it's going to have a net positive effect on developer productivity right off the bat, or
is
it going to require, for those developers who didn't, as Herb was talking about, experiment with 20 languages to get their hands, exactly, the ones that were reared, and it's going to happen, on C# and VB.net, how are they going to take to a world where all of a sudden they need to start thinking a little bit more about side effects and this kind of strange new programming syntax in an environment that they're already used to programming in? I know you've done great work with Link, but it's still a little different than one is used to
yeah.
as a C# developer. How that's just going to happen over time as
well. I think that the formula is pretty simple. I mean, you if you put in place new language features or new functionality, you have to make sure that there's a big carrot at the end of the learning curve, right? Or greener grass or what? Well, it's
okay.
Perhaps more productivity. Perhaps, you know, like you could do now in 10 lines what you previously had to do in 100 lines.
Okay.
You got more productive. Yes, you had to learn how to write those 10 lines, but hey, once you learned how to write those, now that transfers to the next 10 or the next 10 or the next 10 you write, and you're more productive, fewer bugs, you know. I mean, it's it's a pretty classic formula,
absolutely,
really. I mean, yeah, so.
And then it'll also be more composable.
Yeah.
Something you can hide, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's the same code they always wrote, but now you can mouse over and grab some and just execute that. You know, it's some of it you can make very smooth. Some of it's going to have a learning step, and that's where great language designers come in. And they say, how can we make this as similar and fit as well to the language that's already there and have the concepts that work in the language already work well with this and vice versa, so we don't just have, oh, by the way, there was C# 3, and now we have this extra silo of features.
Yeah.
They don't really talk much to C# 3, but they're in the same compiler, and you can use them in separate code.
Yeah.
You definitely don't want to go there, and no sane person would. So how well do you integrate them? That's always a challenge.
That's the beauty of Link, too, because there was a segue. First, we had iterators in for each, and then you get this new for syntax. That's, if you've ever seen SQL, it's kind of familiar, and it's segue, it's step by step, it's learning by baby steps. You don't have to swallow the whole functional programming zeitgeist to take advantage of Link. You can just get there in little bits.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, to me the real value is that we're applying functional programming principles to a very, very real world problem,
yes.
Which is query and data access and eradicating the impedance mismatch between the data domain and general purpose programming domain.
Certainly.
You know, that's something that like 80% of our the C# users, you know, deal with every day. Right?
Absolutely.
So there's value there, clearly.
That's a big
pain
point. Yeah, and it's been for decades.
The same thing's going to happen too with adding concurrency. If you just add a new silo of features, oh, by the way, and if you want to write concurrent code, use those other features and it doesn't play with the rest.
Right.
That's a recipe for failure. Nobody would ship that or buy it or use it except a few people who have way too much time and don't ship anything. So nobody would do that.
Uh-huh.
But on the other hand, you're going to say, how will I add this so that I can take the things I already do, but they're painful to do by hand,
mm-hmm.
and now I have abstractions that let me do it. The example I always like to use is objects, because everybody does objects now. It's the most boring and pedestrian thing in the world, because who doesn't know what a virtual function is? But 20 years ago, we went to conferences with deep, insightful, zen kind of topics,
yeah.
like, what is an object? What is a virtual function? You had people who wrote entire books of varying quality about that. And it wasn't so much that this objects thing was brand new.
Mm-hmm.
People have been writing object-oriented code in C for 15 years before then.
Oh, yeah.
If you look at the C standard library, fopen, it constructs you a handle. And you call ftel, and it takes the handle. That's an explicit this parameter. You call fclose, that's a destructor. So none of this stuff was new.
Hmm.
So why would people use a class instead? Well, I don't want to write my vtables by hand anymore, thank you. I have other things I'd like to do. And so these abstractions are for things that people are already doing, and to some extent that validates the design is good. Does it help you write what you're already writing in a painful way, but in an easier way?
Mm-hmm.
That certainly applies to concurrency abstractions, to dealing with threads and locks manually today is much like writing C code. So what's the OO for concurrency? These new abstractions that make concurrency easier. And
mm-hmm.
so when we talk about this kind of composability, what makes composability easier? Link actually falls on a couple of those, because composability and concurrency are pretty tightly related.
Mm-hmm.
And how can I compose these two things to run together in the same address space, for example,
yeah.
is a variant, a form of that question. And so Link actually, because of its inherently abstracted nature where I talk about what I'm trying to do rather than the details of how I'm trying to do it,
mm-hmm.
that lets your runtime system start taking over the scheduling and the spreading across, oh, you've got 4 CPUs, oh, you've got 16 with the same exe, and run well on whatever hardware it happens to have without you having to make those decisions as a programmer.
Mm-hmm.
Today we do all that by hand. It's time we stop writing vtables by hand, but we need to provide better tools so people can stop doing it, use the abstractions, and then write 10 lines instead of 100.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good point.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that I think we're not yet doing well is to design our languages such that computers can help us program. So it's like a lot of stuff is you have to do it by hand. And I think if you look at type inference, what are we doing there? We're using computing power to help us, you know, kind of find out things that we know about our programs. And if you want to do concurrency, you want to design your program language such that the tools or the computer can help you to do more concurrency. And I think there, you know, there's a lot of progress that we can make there, where we really design our tools such that other tools can kind of, you know, make it better. And then you get this kind of flywheel effect, because now, you know, you make progress. And I think now a lot of things, even the runtime, like, you know, because we have metadata, now you can get like garbage collection and so on. So this is, I think, for me, the kind of trend is how can you design your programming languages and your environment such that other programs can kind of hook in and help you with that. And in some sense, you know, if you look at unmanaged code, well, that's so amorph that, you know, tools cannot do much with it, right? Because there's not enough structure. So that's kind of, you know, what I think is things that's driving us. And a lot of it sort of stuff that we talked about can be viewed in that way.
Absolutely. So how much, I wanted to ask this question, how much abstraction is too much? So how far are you guys going to go with your abstraction? I mean, at some point, am I not going to be writing code anymore?
Well, I mean, let me take a crack at a little bit of what I have seen typically is a problem with abstraction is that people, there's a difference between moving the abstraction level up or adding levels of abstraction. And I think often we're guilty of moving or sliding the abstraction level up, which means you get to program in these wonderful workflowy business concepts or whatever, right? But then down the bottom felt, well, unfortunately, now you can't call methods or you can't write an expression or do something that you used to be able to do, right? And so you gain some and then you lost some on the bottom, and then it's sometimes it's a wash, right? I think it's important to add levels of abstraction. You don't take away at the bottom. You know, yes, you can talk about workflows or rules or whatever or declarative thingamajiggies, but you can still get down and dirty and write those two lines of code that saved your day, right?
Sure.
You just don't have to get there as often, but the escape hatch is there. Mm. And to me, that is, you know, really it's the spectrum of abstraction that defines the power of a tool, not the level of abstraction, if you follow what I'm saying.
Sure, that's exactly right.
Yes.
It's much the same thing as we already do when we write a library. We write a function, then we call it by name. We don't repeat the 100 lines of code. So the programmer can do that for themselves a lot, but when it comes to language features, there's sometimes where you don't expect the programmer to just write another part of the compiler for you. You really want the language to help you and the tools to help you. And the boundary tends to be basically between the library and the language. Where do you really want tools help? Because the tools have got to know about it. If it's going to affect the way the code is generated, then you can't just rely on the programmer to write another class or a framework or something. Because people can shoot themselves in the foot when they're writing frameworks too, and making them very ornate and complex and impossible to understand. There's a lot of those.
Well, by definition, I think you cannot have too much abstraction, because abstraction means leaving out unnecessary detail. So if detail is unnecessary, you can abstract from it. Right? But I think what Anders is saying
would be wonderful if it were true.
Yes, but the thing is, I think
some people raise it and then leave out necessary.
Exactly,
detail.
And I think that's exactly what Anders is saying. Right? Sometimes
you're
abstract from necessary details, or you cannot get, and then abstraction has gone too far. But then, in my definition, you have not really abstracted because you have taken away necessary details.
Maybe we should call that destruction.
Yes. Yes. Yep.
Yes. So that's someone's coming in for this.
Yeah.
Oh, what
if we're losing our room?
Losing, or did we run out of?
We have 1 minute. We're
okay.
Not done yet. So that's an excellent point. I mean, the levels of abstraction versus just moving things up, and then not giving you access.
No,
to
level versus spectrum.
Yeah, level versus spectrum.
Yeah.
But then again, I mean, wouldn't you? There's certain things that you can't get at in the CLR, for example. So when I'm writing a fully managed application, it's not that easy for me to get to certain low-level constructs without having to use the pretty complicated p-invoke model.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
yeah. But imagine a world where p-invoke wasn't there. I mean, yes. No, but really, but that would be an example of moving the level up, right?
Mm-hmm.
But instead, the escape hatch is there. Now, we, of course, will labor as hard as we can to make it so that you never have to go there. But if you do have to go there, you can go there, right?
Fantastic.
And
if you just seal it off, you just make yourself inapplicable.
Yeah, because there are certain scenarios that just fall off the plate for silly reasons, right? I mean,
So before we go, let's quickly go around. Give me, where are we going?
with languages. Like in the real, I mean, without getting specific, I mean, like, what, where are we going with this constantly evolving language situation? Let's just go around quickly and tell me, like, where you think people are going to be in, you know, 5 years or so. What's important to you to get to provide for developers in your language? How's that? I mean, that's kind of vague, but.
Well, I mean, I think we're seeing this fusing of disciplines, right? Mm-hmm. That's, that to me is sort of one of the mega trends that I think big problems that, that need to be solved that sort of loom on the horizon is what do we do with many core? What are better concurrent programming models, you know, that, that very briefly.
Excellent.
My motto used to be, let's make mathematicians into better programmers. My motto now is, let's make programmers into better mathematicians. I want programming languages to look more like mathematics.
Uh-huh. Well, I want to kind of, you know, enhance the human intellect by having tools. I mean, the computers are much more powerful than we are, so I want, you know, the computer to help me program, and I want to design my programs in such a way that that is possible.
Many things have already been said, yeah. Borrowing especially from functional styles into imperative languages, that's a trend that's easy to predict without coming afoul of January 1st, 2008. And yeah, having to live up to it. That one will be good for a few more years. And being able to address concurrency issues especially at a level of abstraction that gets us above threads and locks.
Yeah.
A lot of people are working on that. So
absolutely.
From transactional memory to active objects to everything else, Link has a future there. Many of the good work that's being done in non-concurrent places will directly be able to leverage that, and so we'll continue to work on those things and bringing them all together.
Fantastic. Well, it's a bummer that I didn't get this conference room for more time, but not that you guys don't have anything else to go do, but this is really great stuff, and thank you very much. I'd love to talk to you guys again and just check in with where your thinking is with the evolution of programming languages, and thank you so much for your time.
Yeah.